Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we're back into data again. I think we do a lot in the digital world because Martin, you live on Twitter.
Yes, it is compulsory, but it's not obligatory.
But is it true you're now on that Insta Snapgram chat?
yeah, I like that stuff. I put a picture of my feet on it, and my kids are like, "Why did you put a picture of your feet on it?"
Don't, lads, if anybody wants to be upset, follow Martin on Instagram. All of this. Tell the listeners what your Instagram name is.
Voice Like Chocolate.
Oh, God, save him. There's no saving him. Much more importantly, after laughing, Jack has finished over there. We're delighted to be joined in the Tortoise Shack by London-based writer, speaker on technology, policy, politics, and the future, Maria Farrell. Maria, thank you so much for coming into the podcast.
Oh, thanks very much for having me in. Thrilled to be here.
We met a few months back at an event in Rathmines, and we had a quick chat. And we were, saying, come on, we'll get you in next time you're in town. Since then, the nerds that we are, then we go and do a bit of more reading, a bit of falling down the rabbit hole and seeing some of the stuff. You've done a lot of work, obviously, on security data and things like that. Do you want to give us just a quick sort of overview of some of the work that you do and why it really matters?
Oh, sure, yeah. So I've worked in technology policy for about 20 years, which is kind of horrifying to be old enough to have worked in anything for 20 years, but that creeps up on you. I suppose I started off doing tech policy in London and then in Brussels and Washington, different kind of tech organizations. And now I mostly do writing and teaching. So, in fact, I was supposed to be teaching next week. The funding got pulled a bit, but, on a course I've been teaching for 5 years, which is a doctoral program in cybersecurity. And I was going to give them a whole thing for the whole week about basically I do geopolitics and domestic policy and cybersecurity. And, it was going to be all about political narratives, how we think about things. So I think a lot of the stuff I'm thinking about at the moment actually is not just kind of, you know, Russian disinfo and how does it work, or surveillance capitalism, why must we have it? You know, more like how are the ways that we think about things, the way we tell stories about things, how is that kind of shaping the possibilities that we think are open to us, or in fact the possibilities we think are closed. So that sounds slightly nebulous, I think, probably, but I'm sort of thinking about storytelling and the future and thinking up futures that we want to live in. That's my big thing for this year.
Yeah, and I think that's a real positive thing to say, because we can tend to go, oh, the Russians hacked this is going on here, you know, this has been manipulated. But the reality is I want to bring it to a simple trope that I think was Philip O'Connor shared with us as a journalist. He said, it's a great time to be a journalist. He said, he said, the world is a lot easier to get information that you need, to get to work with sources that you want, to actually, if you want to write the story, you can write the story. It's the economic monetizing that of the model that actually is, you know, under attack. And when you talk about surveillance capitalism, you know, I remember, I think it was one of your videos where you showed a Twitter icon surrounded by golden handcuffs and the likes of. And we know that there are kind of gilded cages, there are gatekeepers, but nonetheless, there is so much space there for some creativity, and particularly in the realm of democracy, in because we keep hearing X or Y is a threat to our democracy, or Martin sent a tweet and is going to bring down the system. But
I wish.
Yeah, but given that, and I know I'm labouring the question here, but the fact is, it's right to contextualise it, because we can have these conversations now. We can actually have a podcast that people listen to that wasn't possible a few years ago, and now we're seeing that there's opportunities there. So just taking that a step forward. You know, do you think that we are overly negative about it, or?
I think we're probably in a weird moment at the moment where we have stopped believing the very pretty lies that we told ourselves about the internet and how the internet was going to, bring freedom and democracy to the world, and the internet was going to bring the Arab Spring, and it was going to, you know, let people all over the world stage revolutions, and it was going to bring down inequality, it was going to open up, you know, media channels to all sorts of people. And some of that stuff it's done, for sure, but then, I think we got overly, I think, simplistic and naive about it, and we're kind of now at the moment of realizing, oh, okay, so the companies that were collecting all the data about us and selling that, it turns out that that's a really trivially easy data set to crack and use to manipulate people, or even potentially to just make people feel they're being manipulated and so destroy their faith in democratic institutions and the free press and all of those things. So we're sort of at the, I guess maybe the first little like downward blip, you know, in what is a really complex ongoing process. You know, we've only had the internet for 20 years. So it's really new, really new. You know, and it's having all kind of weird interaction effects, I think, is the, you know, it's not like it's all terrible. It's not like it's all wonderful. For sure, I think there's one of the, what I hope will turn out to have been teething problems, really, is in the long run, in which we are all dead, of course. but I think is advertising is the original sin of the internet. You know, this idea that we could have to have free platforms, and these platforms had to be driven by people's data and by making people not just collect and make their data available, but also making people incentivize them to click through content. So, you know, by doing the by basically taking away the advertising from the media, you killed the media and business model, but also by incentivizing, you know, people to look at more and more extreme content, you've become an engine for radicalization. So there are these kind of, you know, this stuff has gone on, and we've kind of come to a point where we've gone, oh shit, like this is basically a very, very good machine for bringing down democracy. And to some extent it is. And in fact, I'm going to give a plug here for one of my brothers. He's an academic in America, and he just wrote a paper with a really, really terrific cybersecurity guy called Bruce Schneier. And their paper is called, and my brother's a political scientist, so it's kind of InfoSec plus political science. And the paper is called Common Knowledge Attacks on Democracy. And they basically have come up with a really intuitive, really good way to think about why is it that disinformation, social media, is so inimical to healthy democracy, and at the same time, why are there features of it that are so bad for democracy, so good for authoritarians? So it's not just that Putin and co. are able to use disinfo to destabilize democracies abroad, and they are, but it's also that they're able to use disinfo to strengthen their own power structures, their own vertical power structures within their own countries. So it's a really, really useful way to think about, you know, what's going on, just a bit more, you know, deeper than the level of, oh crap, Facebook lied to Congress. Of course Facebook lied to Congress. So I recommend it, Common Knowledge Attacks on Democracy.
I'll
have to look that one up, definitely have to look that one up. Moving on a little, you do other things besides existential threats to the modern world. You tackle other issues. Tell us about the other stuff that you do.
Yeah, well, so in the last year or two, I've developed this kind of funny little sideline, because now I'm mostly writing for my living. And one of the weird things I've started doing is writing what we call near future science fiction. And so I get clients to pay me to write stories for them. Who do you like?
Yeah, but Martin, Martin just thinks now in terms of everybody, how dark and bleak can he make it?
I like dystopian stuff. I love dystopian stuff.
But you know what? Dystopia writes itself these days.
It does.
It's too easy.
It is, yeah.
But yeah, no, so so I kind of get clients, mostly technology companies, trade associations and that, who want to have stories to go along with their reports or kind of, you know, landmark events that they're doing that basically say, what's life going to be like
what's
in 20
next?
Years? Yeah, what's next? So I'm writing one at the moment for a European trade association that does kind of runs all the country code top level domains, so the .ie, the .de, .frs, and it's all about basically the story I'm doing for them is in the future how will kind of distributed identity systems, which is what they do. What if we have some weird mashup with that and the refugee crisis, as some people call it, or the perfectly predictable movement of peoples, as others call it? You know, what are the ways that we could do distributed ID that can actually open up possibilities for people for citizenship, for opportunity in the future? So it's trying to take kind of big ideas and make stories out of them that are believable people.
Yeah, write a narrative that's going to give people and show a non-Martin optimistic version of how things can actually, how technology can improve things, because that is ultimately that there is we can I can produce a statistic from the World Bank to say that we've, you know, capitalism has lifted more people out of poverty in the last 100 years in the history of humanity. You can also then produce a counter one that says, well, actually, you're basing that on $1.90 a day. If I base it on $5 a day, inequality has grown over the last 20 years. Okay, so but what we can't lose sight of is that infant mortality, and, you know, and technology has played a part in that, whereby we can spread ideas a lot better, and we can actually, there's a 6-inch piece of plastic in your hand half the time that you can actually access a global library, for want of a better term. But taking that, and we don't want to be negative, we've spoken to Jess Kelly from News Talk, that their tech correspondent, and she's very optimistic about the potential of tech to change things. But we've also spoken to other people who then see the data capture piece and say the dangers of that, as, and Martin, you get quite, you know, what is your phrase? Data always leaks.
Yeah, always leaks.
It's a feature, not a bug.
You can't stop it from leaking.
No, and most people who capture it don't want to stop it.
And I suppose that's the point. Is it incumbent on us as the people who are sharing our information to actually just move to that paradigm where we accept that our data is now the public is going to be in, whether it's the public domain or in a corporate domain, we have to understand that we've given it freely and it will be distributed like that, or
Yeah, I would profoundly disagree with that. I'll tell you why. Because I think there's this idea that you lost your privacy, get over it. And so, you know, which is another way of saying, hi, I run a big platform, will you go away and let me keep on making shed loads of money and, you know, offshoring it and not paying taxes, etc. And it's and the tax thing to the side, which it should never be, but let's put it there for the moment. The problem really is that we've moved into a paradigm where, because of various properties of the internet and data, states are, and also because of, you know, privatization and the narrowing of the public sphere, states are much less powerful vis-a-vis corporate interests than 20, 30, 40 years ago. And as, you know, so we kind of have a data model where citizens are more or less being served up by states to corporates to give their data. So in the UK, you have the NHS whose data is being cracked wide open and given for free to an Alphabet Google company, DeepMind. And, you know, completely against the law, and the Data Protection Commissioner was not particularly interested in enforcing the law. And they've sort of done a nice little fudge now and everybody's happy with it, except it's really not okay. So you've kind of got this situation where people are being told that they have no choice about things and that they have no agency. And I think that's kind of driving a lot of the, you know, dissatisfaction we all feel at the moment. But when you look at the levers that we have to pull to change how tech platforms work, they are significant and we don't even have our hands on them, let alone pulling them. So you can look at competition policy, for example, where in the US and in Europe, there are absolutely lots of remedies to look at, you know, dominance in markets.
Breaking
so that would
up,
be,
yeah.
Break, yeah. So even, you know, are you dominant in the market? Yes, you are. If you're Facebook, you know, have you used your dominance in one market to go into another one? If you're Google, yes, you have. Are you, you know, destroying opportunities for kind of, you know, local firms? If you're Amazon, yes, you have.
For competition.
Right, for competition. So there are lots of ways we can use competition policy to do enforcement. And that's what states do. You know, the state is the legal purveyor of coercion within the boundaries.
You say that's what states do. I get a little bit, because if you think about in terms of some of the incentives we've given to some of these companies, we've said to them, research and development, if you go into that, we'll reduce your, in Ireland, we can give you a 2% tax rate on new development. And what they tend to do is they tend to reach out, find someone who's coming up with something, buy them, park them. It doesn't matter whether it succeeds or fails or not. They just want the tax offset on their own profits, and it actually kills the competition. And then more dangerously, and I mean that as, and this is me contradicting my initial question, where, what is it, 10 companies make up 40% of Ireland's corporate tax take last year.
Wow, that's scary.
That's how vulnerable we are to...
And Ireland's corporate tax take is now similar to the property charges, in that we're over-reliant on our corporate tax now. Very dangerous situation. Very, very dangerous situation.
Well, that's just... you can say dangerous, or you could say an opportunity, or you could say vulnerable. Depends on what side of the table you're sitting. But there's definitely, as you mentioned, the levers of power for control. Ireland is very well positioned to do something because many of these big tech companies are domiciled here.
Yeah.
And the onus should be on us to...
To do this. Well, I mean, Ireland is in a very, very invidious position, which it has gleefully put itself into. I mean, the thing that I, strikes me as, you know, a way to just to compare Ireland to. So I live in London, and there you have all of the, you know, the plutocrats and the dirty money and the people coming in, you know, using all these unbelievable luxury services, and you sort of have the English, it's a peculiarly English thing, who think they're doing really well by say, you know, guys that went to school with Prince Harry run nightclubs and concierge services that they, you know, make available to Saudi or Russian billionaires. And the English guys think they're really doing really well, kind of selling their social capital to the highest bidder. And this is a really kind of cool thing for them to do. Actually, they're basically just butlers for the global elite. And Ireland is kind of in a similar position in that it's kind of going around doing the dirty business for people who, you know, despise you in a way, and actually, and is so much further down the totem pole than it thinks it is. You know, our self-image is much different to the reality of, yeah, you do the dirty court. You're basically the Delaware of the world. You know,
well, we had Colin Regan in, and he basically said the same thing that the people who make money in this country don't have a vested interest in this country. They're in Silicon Valley. They're in different places. So the social structures within Ireland don't really mean a whole lot to them. It's profits, just profits, profits, profits. That's all that matters. There's no vested interest in what Ireland is or what it's to become.
No. And so you see, you know, these business models, you know, the Amazon business model is based on, and so is the Uber model, based on not paying tax. Mm. You know, their competitive advantage is that they are not subject to the regulatory cost burden that other companies, that, you know, local competitive companies are. So on the one hand, you're hollowing out the provision of public services of the state by not paying tax. On the other hand, you're killing innovation by having a false advantage. But also, going back to the innovation point, you're basically saying, well, you know, that most of those large companies acquire hundreds of other companies every year. Yep. And some of it is to take the, you know, functionalities and incorporate them into the platform. A lot of it is just to kill them stone dead, because there's what, I'm trying to remember the term for it. There's sort of the kill zone, it's called, which is, you know, a tech company that gets to a certain size and it will be taken over by a Google or a Facebook and killed, because once it gets to a certain size, it has the potential to be a competitor, for a rival for the large company in the future. So they buy them. They've got all of this capital, which is sitting overseas, which has never been used to pay tax, and they're just sitting on it. Yeah. They just buy the future competition and kill it. And that's why I think is what's kind of peculiar about what's happening at the moment is we are locking in a certain market structure and certain market dominance that could be with us for 2030.
We've actually incentivized it.
Yeah.
We've genuinely incentivized it. And not only have we've incentivized it to the tune whereby 13 of said top 100 companies in Ireland paid less than 2% tax because they're able to do those things. So if you think of what our corporate tax take was relative to what it should be at 12%, if they were paying at 12%, we've locked in incentives to actually say to them, Martin, you said Aidan Regan spoke about that they weren't here or that they hadn't got much skin in the game. Well, they do employ people. There's no question that they're at their highest level in the history of the state. We're up 45% since 2006, 2007. It's a significant number of people. That's not the argument, though. The argument is still remains. We're the best, I call it waven pipes, for filtering the stuff across.
Oh, yeah.
And the money just passes through, and if we're lucky to skim a little bit off it as it comes along, this is what we do. But it's the same it's the same across many of our industries. I mean, we have in the IFSC, what is it, 10 times the size of the Irish GDP passes through the IFSC, unregulated, really, by our central bank, because they say, well, if that's the bank in Italy, the mothership has to deal with them. We don't regulate it. Yeah. So that is our business model, for want of a better term.
Yeah, it's our national business model.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think a lot of what I spend my time thinking and writing about is, let's look clearly at what we are. Let's be honest with ourselves about who we are. Are we happy as a country to be a butler? Are we happy as a country to be a serf? You know, do we want to be kind of the sort of in the bottom, the top half of the bottom third of global data feudalism? Is that where we see our future? You know, or do we have a bit more ambition?
Process? Well, I think you're dead right to call it feudalism. And I think you're dead right to call it. And it, increasingly it's becoming more and more feudalistic. Increasingly it is. And we have to be able to sit back and say, what have we changed that we are now reverting back to a system that we couldn't wait to get away from? And we're heading back. And it's not that we're heading back. We're actually in a feudalistic system. You can call it neoliberal. You can call it whatever you like. But it's feudalistic. That's exactly what it is.
It is. And the thing about these sorts of systems is they, when they become embedded, you're kind of looking at 2 centuries of it before you can actually break out of it again. So, you know.
That's the optimistic in
you. That's the historian to you. I did history at UCD. So that's kind of my, yeah. You know, I always take the long view on these things. And so that's why I think it's really important, you know, when I talk about being clear-eyed about things, what I mean is that, is understanding that, you know, the shape of market structure, this incredibly concentrated, offshore market structure that we live in and that we sort of seem to think is as inevitable as air. You know, it is a choice. It is a series of choices that we are making, and we can make different choices.
And here's the funny thing about the power of technology. So with the power of technology, I know when we go in on our data, Martin, we have 17% of people are listening to this aren't living in Ireland. Okay, they're listening across the globe, and we can share that information and we can exchange ideas. We can do that, and yet we know when it comes to the market, the global financial capital that flows in and out, and that technology makes so much more easy to do. We then turn around and say, well, everyone for himself. And we don't really, because Ireland has to admit, like, we don't like to say here that we're a tax haven in Ireland. They don't like to say it. But everybody else around the world talks about us as a tax
haven.
Everyone
in Brussels says it, believe me. Oh, we're not fooling anyone.
I've seen some wonderful reports that actually blatantly call it out. Like the $200 billion per year, they reckon is the money forgone globally by filtering through just some of Ireland, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, and some of the practices that are going on. That's money coming off dinner tables across the world. And at some point we have to be able to exchange the ideas and say, do we want to break that market structure, and do we do that? Someone who does tries to be optimistic about it, have you encountered or seen any people who are trying to get that message out there that it's international solidarity as much as anything else?
On the tax thing, I mean, obviously there are organizations that do that, and you know, every now and then you see an announcement from the G7, meet and say, oh, we really must do something about this. But I think, I mean, it's, you know, I've always been really distrustful of approaches that rely on individuals' moral and ethical sense and social responsibility and that. But weirdly, I'm coming to this really unwillingly, but, you know, over the last year, we've seen changes that have happened at Google withdrawing from the military Maven project because, you know, their senior engineers were not happy about it. Google again, engineers, security and privacy people saying, you know, we cannot go into China, Project Firefly on the basis that they're doing it. There does seem to be some kind of shift that is happening with, by understanding that people who work for these companies are also, you know, voters, want to live in democracies, want to have functional states, want there to be functioning social, you know, health and education systems. And so there is something to be said for, I guess, the bully pulpit, that sort of thing. I mean, you know, I had a conversation with Tim Cook 2 months ago about this sort of thing, because I, you know, met him at a conference, and that we were both speaking at. And I think certainly in that company, which is far from perfect, but there is a growing realization. In fact, he is evangelical. He is now, you know, out going and talking about the fact that Apple wants to be different from Facebook and Google in terms of how they want to be, how they want to act. Are they helping democracy? Are they hindering it? Are they, you know, people who are allowing the far right to flourish, or are they a company that is not allowing that to flourish on their platform? And so, you know, that's sort of coming from the top, but I think it's also coming from a lot of people within the organization. And as flawed as that model is, and I would be the first to say it, it's something. And I think, you know, any change that we've ever achieved in history and across politics is by making coalitions with people with whom we do not agree on about absolutely everything.
Yeah.
And so when you see somebody like that standing up, it's not like you give them a free pass, but you do kind of go, okay, yeah, there are some people here who are doing good. We can make common cause on this. Now, you know, I see that you sorted out democracy there, Tim Cook. Now, can we talk about taxation? Let's move the conversation forward. So there's something to be said about that. But I think mostly, you know, I do kind of come back to, look, a lot of this is we have state power, we have regulation, we actually need to use it, and we not need to stop being so fearful about using the power that we have.
Well, I think fearful for me, particularly in Ireland, I know it's other countries, that describes the model of governance we have. Afraid to rock the boat, afraid that if they take any steps that we would have seen very easy to take in the past, such as simple things like building social housing, that is now a disincentive for their voter base. If they build social housing, they no longer have that ABC one who is saying, you know, they don't deserve free houses. You know, they lose those votes. So they're fearful of doing, I think they know what the right thing to do is. I think they're just fearful of doing it for losing votes, for the short term gain. And as you were saying, Cook is looking at it, maybe a longer term.
Yeah.
You know, how do you make your company sustainable over 50 years rather than over 5 years?
Right, exactly. And you know what? Yeah, it just reminds me. I mean, you know, there are certain players in the world who are acting in that way. Democracy right now is not doing well about thinking long term. Obviously, we can see that with climate breakdown.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you look at, obviously, a country like China, they clearly have their climate change strategy in place. You know, it's Tibet and they're hanging on to it because that's where the water is. Mm-hmm. You know, when you look at a company like Apple, I think, and also they have a long vision simply because they're selling hardware, not data. So, you know, there are things that are fundamental to who they are. But I had a slightly chilling experience, I suppose, about early first quarter of last year. I was doing a client job for a company which must remain nameless in Silicon Valley. And they were just getting me to write some comms materials for them. And they were a blockchain company doing something particular with the internet, kind of in a slightly infrastructural area that I know about. And from talking to them to try and understand who they were so that I could communicate their offering to the world, we had some pretty frank discussions about this particular piece of infrastructure they wanted to do with blockchain. Why? Not just because, like everyone else who's using blockchain, because it's there, you know, but actually because they felt that centralized naming and numbering systems were vulnerable to falling away in the next 10 years. Because as far as many people in Silicon Valley are concerned, democracy as we know it is going to go away in the next decade, and the ability, the capacity of the state to do centralizing things, the ability of the economy to do kind of collective things is all going to go away. And so basically they're looking at, and I don't even want to say the word, but some sort of near-term apocalypse.
Yeah, there's an anarcho viewpoint, and it's very prevalent in parts of Silicon Valley where you have people discussing things like transhumanism and these moving beyond, and how there will be literally fortified areas, and everybody else outside the fortified areas is kind of
zombie.
Detritus. Yeah, and conversations are happening, and they're happening at surprisingly high levels.
And New Zealand has had to ban land purchases of over a certain amount by foreigners because they were basically all going to buy New Zealand and go there. But it's kind of chilling when you're kind of looking at a person on a Skype call and they're a very sane, reasonable person, and their business model isn't democracy is going away, let's make a boatload of money in the next 10 years because we're going to need it. But their business model is democracy is going away, so we need to help make sure this infrastructure will be still in place. You know, so their heart is in a good place and they're trying to do something, but it's chilling. You know, and so there are people who are planning for this, and, you know, our look at Trump and his wall. That is a climate change strategy right there.
Yeah.
You know, that is the movement of peoples, which will be driven by climate change. We're building the wall. You know, we might be denying that climate change is happening, but our actions speak louder. So I think, you know, there is a question like democracy as it's currently built and used and conceived of is not able to provide that kind of long-term decision-making, and unite it with shareholder capitalism and quarterly reporting, well, we're kind of fucked.
There's a classic, democracy born in Greece, exported in Rome, franchised in the U.S. Oh, no, franchised in the U.K. and murdered in the U.S. That's one of my favourite tropes. But knowing that, while all of that is true. There's no question all of that is true. We also have the means to make positive change, because we know that there is enough capital anywhere to sort out. Like the solutions to the world's problems exist. It's a lack of implementation that we always lack. You talked about climate breakdown. Again, Ireland, there we are again, sticking out like a sore thumb. Not
surprised by that.
No, yeah. It's year on year, every report, it becomes worse and worse. In terms of some of the work you've done, what would be your feeling on it? And particularly, could you give us an idea in terms of some of the things that you, positive things that you've seen internationally that we don't really talk about here?
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, when I said a moment ago that we're fucked, that is kind of slightly playing for effect, because I think the idea that, sorry to be littering your podcast with expletives, but the idea that we are fucked is itself, that's an idea of power. That's an idea of privilege. That's an idea of, you know what? It's all crap. And I'm just going to throw my toys at the pram and have a good time and, go to sleep on my bed of money and screw everybody else. Mm. You know, or it's the despair of everything is crap and nobody can do anything. And it's basically, the Spectator magazine. It's like everyone's just a bit shitty. And so there's nothing we can do. Humans are awful.
Yeah, I'm all right, Jack.
And it's so I think some people of a kind of resentful frame of mind find that kind of philosophy consoling. I do not. And so there's great stuff going on. So, I mean, I think the stuff I'm working on at the moment is basically trying to remind ourselves, one, that we have many, many possible futures. And I think a lot of the hopelessness that is going around climate change and democracy and inequality is very much, it beds in power, it beds in decisions. It basically says your future is just going to be the same as the present, but just a bit shittier. And that's rubbish. That's absolute rubbish, because obviously there are plenty of resources in the world. Obviously, there's plenty of capital. It's all kind of sitting in offshore accounts. There are lots of ways to do things. So one of the ideas I had for this, this conversation was, I've decided now to term the Happy Lefty Book Club.
Yes, yes.
And this is, just to tell you about some of the stuff I've read, and written about a bit in the last year, which is, people on the left who are thinking about the future in incredibly, not Pollyanna happy ways, but like saying, look, these are the possible futures that are open to us, and these are some of the ways we can move towards them. Mm. There's really good stuff happening.
Yeah.
So, okay, science fiction. We need to talk science fiction.
Yes.
Do either of you read science fiction?
I do.
What do you read?
Oh, God, I read pretty much everything, and I like old science fiction, particularly I would have rated that one of the best science fiction stories I ever read is one called A Far Sunset. I don't know if you've ever
heard. No, who's it by?
Oh, God, I can't even remember the author at the moment. It's a classic from the 1960s. It's a very small book. It's a very good book. But I read pretty much anything that comes up, or I watch everything sci-fi, particularly
Edmund Cooper, by the way.
Yes, Edmund Cooper. But pretty much anything I like the near concept.
Near future science fiction.
What's going to happen in the next 10 years? What's going to happen in the next 20 years?
Yeah.
I'm very much sort of on the negative on that, the way things are structured at the moment.
Yeah, but look, I mean, so people are, we've had basically a decade of dystopia. YA was young, adult fiction was just all dystopia, and all the grown-ups were kind of peering over their shoulders and reading it as well. And I think dystopia tends to be what people write. It's sort of projecting into the future, our fears about the present. Whereas utopia is, of course, harder to write, but it kind of tends to open up possibilities rather than close them down. So one of the writers I just think is amazing and everyone should be reading is an American guy called Kim Stanley Robinson. And he writes fiction about climate change, science fiction, and he writes near future science fiction, and he writes space opera. Basically, somewhere in this sweet spot of those three things, this fabulous Venn diagram, and at the very center of it is a bunch of books he's working on at the moment. One of them I read this time last year, and it's called New York 2140. And it's about what will New York be like in 120 years and in 2140. And he says basically it's this fantastic novel that opens in New York, which is like Venice, except it's kind of alive and flourishing, and it's full of all sorts of, you know, mad characters, and sea levels have risen. Mm. And so it's, so New York is basically, you know, you drive around in canals. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And so it's kind of, and so the conceit of the book is it's basically about people who all live in one building, and a couple of them are two feral kids who kind of have no parents. And one is a market trader who's coming up with a new kind of an index, to a financial index to track the value of what they call the intertidal. So how do you calculate the value of property that is within the tidal zone, the washing in and out zone?
Right.
So, and it's really tricky because that allows them to introduce this idea of financial discount formula. So how do we calculate the value of an asset right now? Well, one of the ways we do it, if you know corporate finance, is of course you say, well, how much is this going to be worth to us in the future? You know, how many kind of revenues will we get in from it? And the corporate finance formulae that you use, basically you can decide how much to discount the future. Mm. So, you know, if you think the future is probably going to be pretty bad and your asset is not going to be worth as much in the future, you know, you'll have a different discount rate. And so you'll say now is much more important. But Kim Stanley Robinson uses this kind of, this particular character who's quite funny and silly and is constantly trying to pursue women who are completely unsuitable. But he uses this to basically say, look, the kind of arbitrary ways that we calculate the value of assets are literally discounting the future, or literally saying yeah. our value right now, our lives right now are more important than the people who are to come. And that is just a quirk of capitalism as it is currently construed. And so then he has a couple of programmers who come in and try and rewire the algorithms of the whole system to do kind of redistribution. They fail. And then there's kind of a, there are all sorts of lots of different characters kind of moving around in this world. And there's like a fantastic scene with an airship and polar bears loose on an airship. And it's just, it's funny and it's got different people. And the really brilliant thing I love about this book is that while you learn a lot about, you know, what will the technologies be that allow us to live in a world of rising sea levels? And what does, you know, what do financial discounting, how does all that work? And basically, you get to the end of the novel and finally, after several attempts, capitalism has been completely, is being turned around. And not by the efforts of this tiny number of well-chosen protagonists that he happens to have put together in the same building, which always annoys me about novels, you know. Yeah. Oh, they all just happen to know each other.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's actually something that some of those people have a good insight into, so they're good viewpoint characters, yeah, but actually yeah, yeah. you're seeing a mass rebellion, what they call the householder's revolt, of basically people stop putting their money into banks, they put them into credit unions and different kind of financial
yeah,
instruments
and they take down the system.
They take down the system. And so it's also kind of interesting to me because it's sort of like a, it's almost like a social democrat, you know, let's do a revolution without killing anyone.
Mm.
And it kind of works. And also you don't have these fantastic, glorious heroes who just happen to save the hour. I just love it.
There's an interesting complete opposite, polar opposite of that, I think. It was a 1920s book about a utopian future. But it was, I can't think of the author's name. I know he was one of the guys that actually came up with disposable razors at the end of it all. But he had come up with this utopian future, and it was more or less like a socialist model where to each their own. But he was the first person to use in writing, they reckon, the American dream phrase.
Uh-huh.
And the ultimate irony of it was that was adopted and then totally bastardized from his initial idea of that everybody by 1980 was going to be living in this kind of cooperative society, and it became this phrase for, well, actually what it means is you get on, you outdo your neighbor or whatever, you know, the pursuit of happiness is the phrase they use. And it, in the book itself, it was about actually stopping the populist movement at the time. If you remember, they'd only just come out of that age from the 1890s to around the 1920s.
Yeah.
And it was about taking that a step further to actually having a cooperative society. And of course, I think it sold like 20 copies, and he went off and came up with disposable razors, went, became a full capitalist. Made a lot of money going out of that, you know?
Yeah. But it goes to show, like, really non-obvious ideas, some like the disposable razor, but also, you know, some of the utopias that were written around that time. One, say, The Yellow Wallpaper by Charlotte Perkins Gilman.
Yeah.
Fantastic feminist utopia, which is pretty much now how we live.
Mm.
You know, ideas come, one of the ways we kind of socialize ideas is by exploring them in stories, because when you read the story, you care about the people in the story. You experience the, you know, the future utopia through their eyes, and it kind of, it almost models behavior. You understand how it could come about rather than being an abstract idea.
And we've always looked to science fiction. We've always looked, I mean, look at Arthur C. Clarke and satellites. I mean, we have always looked to science fiction for the ideas for the future.
Sorry, I'm not pulling this up. His name was actually Gillette. So I wonder what he came up with.
You think the left needs to start picturing an alternative future?
Alternative future is plural.
Okay.
Right, because utopia is a thing that stops you from becoming too accommodating yourself to the actually quite subjective, arbitrary choices of the present. Mm. You know, utopia isn't just about saying, hey, look at this wild idea out there. Why don't we do that? It's more about training you to imagine different alternative futures. That's what it does. It gives you the freedom, and it basically says, you know, not only is hope a muscle that you have to keep working, but actually your imagination is a muscle. You work that thing. You know, how are we going to have different futures unless we actually start imagining them? Because I think a lot of this present moment is about closing down possibilities, you know, shutting the Overton window, making people think that certain, you know, ideas of, you know, cooperation and sharing and radical democracy, all of those things, that they're silly pipe dreams for teenagers. When in fact, I mean, they are the absolute engine of history. They're the only thing that has ever achieved collective, lasting political change.
And there is, particularly in Western politics at the moment, it's unambitious, it's unimaginative,
it's
so terribly stale.
Yeah.
And has been for quite a long time. It was more radical, we'll say in the 50s, there was more radical visions of where we could go.
We need to move away from the phrase that the people who get up early in the morning, we need to move away from, in Ireland particularly, we have this mindset of that these are people, whereas actually people care for people. You know, that is and if you're totally honest, like we sat with Professor Catherine Connolly, and she was saying, you know, that every act of progress it was born of human kindness. It wasn't born of you know, some guy getting up in the morning and just coming up with this this great idea. There were certain things that put him in a position to be able to make these leaps forward, and they're generally born of human kindness and acts of solidarity, and the word she used was compassion.
Yeah.
And you want to talk about utopia. That's why when you know, the idea that from my mind, I always thought of utopia as something we aspire to. And if you're going to aspire to utopia, that means that you should be moving forward. And sadly, quite often now, we have these linguistic bloody arguments. You know, the government don't talk about homes anymore, to talk about housing solutions. We have these awful,
oh God,
yeah, and that is very Orwellian. That's dystopian. That's you know, I made a joke the other day with another journalist saying we should take shots of Victory Gin every time they say housing solutions. But realistically, I think what you make a really, really great point. We should think bigger and actually and see that it's actually the future. The future's not yet written, and yet there's multiple alternatives. It's a really interesting concept. I'm kind of sitting here going to myself, going, yeah. And as soon as you go now, I'll start buying these books. But
actually, there's an idea. If you wouldn't mind, when you're back on in the Twitter sphere and back, just hashtag Lefty Book Club and just put
happy
down
Happy Lefty Book Club happy,
and just put down a couple of the books. And
absolutely, we'll be delighted
share that
to.
Out.
Yeah.
You're back. To work next week.
Back to work next week. Can I tell you just about one more book?
Is of course, yes. Because
The Happy Lefty Book Club is obviously it's a Twitter hashtag. But I just recently reread a book that I read a year ago. And you know when you read something and you suddenly realise, oh my God, all of those ideas in that I have been rattling around in my head for the last year thinking they're mine, I actually got them here. Mm. And it's almost life-changing, this book. It's called Radical Happiness.
Okay.
And it's by Lynn Segal, S-E-G-A-L. It's by Verso Books, so good British lefty publisher. And she basically takes the phrase radical happiness, which was a phrase created by the American poet and feminist Adrienne Rich, and it was sort of developed a bit by art, taken from something that Hannah Arendt came up with. Basically, it's the idea that happiness is something, and joy is something that is profoundly of the left. and why? Basically because of those, you know, communal sharing, compassion values. There are forms, you know, there are structures of feeling that are around communal and sharing and achieving things together, that are particularly of the left. And she also says, Lynn Siegel in this book, she says, you know, a lot of the happiness agenda, that kind of political thing is sort of tries to put the burden of unhappiness and of depression onto individuals and individual pathologies. Whereas obviously we are living in societies at the moment that are, you know, for lots of reasons to do with austerity or to do with, you know, market values kind of infecting and metastasizing our brains even, you know, that people are, we're living in pro-depression societies, and actually depression is political. But she doesn't spend too much time talking about that, because what she really wants to get into is how is the power of collective joy. And, you know, when you are in movement politics, exhausting and infuriating though it is, you are experiencing stuff with other people, you're working towards a future for everyone, you get, you know, one person's victory is every person's victory. And so she says, you know, that after Hannah Arendt and after Thomas Jefferson, that actually you almost can't be fully happy and flourish in that way that the ancient Greeks talk about unless you are able to exercise some form of public power in, you know, to change, to push your society forward, to be with other people. So she says joy is something that is not, in, you know, happiness is not purely private and personal, that it's actually collective and public. And I think that's something really important to keep our, you know, keep our hands around going into this year, because, you know, I feel we all had a terrible shock over the last 2 years with, you know, various, you know, far right mainstreaming stuff that's happened. But it's also given a lot of fairly complacent people, and I name myself among them, a good, like, you know, a good slap and said, like, you're coasting, you know. And actually, if we want to enjoy the fruits of democracy, and if we want to live in equal society, more equal societies, actually equal societies, let's have a utopian ambition, we are going to need to keep our shoulders to the wheel. But it's okay, because it will be fun. It will be, you know, it's like,
there's joy in it.
There's joy in it. And well, so that's, you know, that's been so important to me.
It's a central tenet of what I've been pushing lately, is that centrism has become complacent.
Very selfish.
Neoliberalism has choked it. And the problem now is that it is a hold what you have ethos, centralism. So, but imagine the joy if you could house 100,000 people in this country. Imagine the national joy if you could do it, that everybody had a home. It's a real feel-good factor. We are that country.
Exactly. It's the confidence and the joy that, and the energy that unleashes to then really get working.
And not only is it good for our mental health, it's good for our wallets, it's good for society, it's good for our future. And the only thing that's stopping it is this block, this mental block that says free houses. And it's nothing to do with free houses. And it's a mental block. And it's how do we move these misery guts that are sitting, all Silas Marner with their...
The gold piles of gold.
This is how I see them. I'm fine. Silas Marner, I'm a centrist. I'm doing okay. We'll change things incrementally. Some of you will die, but I have equity back in my home. So, you know, everything's okay. We need to change that model. We need to say that you're at risk. What you're doing is putting yourself at risk. Where's your self-preservation?
What you're actually doing is you're mortgaging the future, as you said.
You're mortgaging the future with this discount rate. You're also externalizing pain onto other people so that you can hold on to what you have. But I think the thing that people lose sight of when they kind of try and gather their, you know, meager or perhaps, you know, substantial resources into themselves to keep for themselves, to keep their, for their family or for their children. Because people, you know, rationalize an awful lot of bullshit by saying, oh, I have to do this for my kids.
Very easy to find an ideology to
support you. Comfortable life. But the thing is that the more you kind of draw in these kind of resources into yourself and try and keep things for yourself, the less you realize that, you know, none of that stuff is ever going to be enough. Like, we're all going to die, you know, we are all going to die. And so what is the point of having been alive unless we have made things better for other people? It's the only thing that has ever made us feel better as individuals and collectively, is looking after other people, not gathering stuff, you know, but actually making life better for other people. It's the only thing that makes it worthwhile being alive. So happy 2019.
Happy
that's a great, that is a great note to leave it on. And thank you so much for coming in. I know you've gone to a lot of trouble to get here today.
Not at all.
And thank you so much for coming in and having a chat with us. And hopefully again in the future, as we get some, which we're going to get existential shocks, we can have you back on again and we'll discuss these existential shocks.
Be delighted. Thank you.
And it's been terrific. And it's really nice to be optimistic and see. I'm too used to talking about Gramsci and his morbid symptoms, you know, and now we're looking at it in terms of actually the opportunities that we can look at and again.
No, but you know, Gramsci, I mean, pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will.
Well, hey!
You know, that's our boy.
Well, I'm going to go a little bit Seidel Smarner here myself. Look, those of you there sitting counting the money, we need a couple of bob to keep this project going. Please throw the money into the Patreon account. Tony's going to stick the link up at the end of this. And thanks very much for listening.
Thanks for listening, folks. Talk to you all soon. Take care. Bye-bye.